First matter we're going to take up this morning is Phillips versus Virginia. Ms. Givens, Mr. Dolgan, I think y'all both signed in. Okay, wonderful. Ms. Givens, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
4 minutes, please.
All right. And you may come up and prove again whenever you wish.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Givens, and I'm here on behalf of Darnell Phillips. Mr. Phillips was convicted of the 1990 abduction rape of a 10-year-old girl in Virginia Beach. He was sentenced to 100 years in prison. Mr. Phillips has protested his innocence since the moment of his arrest. Finally, on September 25th of this year, after spending 27 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, Mr. Phillips was released on parole, and he's with us here today. His parole petition was based in large part on his actual innocence. He continues, however, to await his exoneration, which is why we're here today. The Commonwealth's case against Mr. Phillips was based on a series of lies, specifically an alleged identification by the 10-year-old victim, an alleged confession that was never documented or corroborated in any way.
Counsel, let me stop you.
Yes.
You would acknowledge, in reference to the confession, that was subject of another appeal, correct?
The confession has been challenged through direct appeal, correct?
Right, and that has been resolved in another proceeding, so that is a matter that has been previously determined in reference to, I guess in terms of characterizing it as either true or not true. That's not something that we can actually dispose of.
Well, Your Honor, I think the basis of the challenge to the confessions are different in these proceedings. I believe the question, you know, in direct appeal proceedings was whether the confession was voluntary, whether it was coerced, whether it was, I'm not sure whether it was a question of whether it was false or contrived completely. We certainly have submitted a fair amount of new evidence in support of the contention that Detective Hoffman's contentions are not worthy of deference or credence
at all.
Well,
can I ask you on that? Because you indicate in your filings with the court that Detective Hoffman had no notes, and which he acknowledges he didn't take notes during the alleged confession. But the way I read your brief, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that there was nothing in writing. Yet the Commonwealth attached to its response a three-page memo that Detective Hoffman wrote to Detective Curl shortly after the alleged confession, describing not only that, but a number of details that he said that he got from Mr. Phillips, and how he got to that point, too. And so can you explain why you allege that there was nothing in writing?
Well, I don't know. I cannot attest to how that report came to be and when it came to be. I can only go on what Detective Hoffman testified to at various proceedings. And I think what's important to remember here is that at multiple proceedings, at the motion to suppress the confession, at the preliminary hearing, at the trial, and during his recent television interview last year with regard to this case, he has said different things, inconsistent things, with regard to how this confession came to be and what kind of documentation he made. He testifies at trial, I believe, and again, maybe I'm getting confused because his testimony is different in different places, that he did, in one instance, he says he took notes during the interrogation and then came outside, dictated the notes, and then produced somebody produced a typed statement. Another instance, he says he did not take notes during the interview, came outside, made quick notes outside, then dictated the notes into a tape recorder, which seems nonsensical to me, and then some notes were generated. But there was nothing produced. There was certainly nothing produced from the defendant. There was nothing produced from any other law enforcement officer. And I submit this, it's absurd on its face to take what Detective Hoffman says. He's suggesting that after denying involvement in this crime to two separate detectives over the course of 2 to 3 hours, that within 7 minutes, of him walking into the room that Mr. Phillips confesses to this crime after protesting his innocence. And that after this confession, Detective Hoffman wants us to believe that he leaves the room and that nobody ever follows up on this at all, that he reports this to the two detectives working the case, and that the two detectives never go back into that room and ask Mr. Phillips, you confessed to this crime, let's write this down, let's get a statement, let's review these notes, or that the prosecutor at no point asks to speak with the defendant or asks the officers to go speak with the defendant to try to get some documentation of this confession. That is absurd, and I submit that is entitled to absolutely no deference, particularly in light of what we know about Detective Hoffman at this point. As we've outlined in our brief,
let's put Detective Hoffman aside for a moment and talk about Detective Curl, because Detective Curl visited the victim in the hospital literally within an hour or two of the attack. She was in the hospital emergency room, and he got a description from her then, before anybody else did, of the perpetrator. And in that description, she referred to him as wearing a Chicago Bulls cap, which the petitioner was seen wearing within an hour or two of the attack in that area. And he said that he was in the park at that time, correct? Around that time.
Yes.
And she also said, although she doesn't remember it in her declaration now, I guess 26 years later, but she says, the person who did this to me has a gold tooth, and it's not in the center of its mouth, it's in the left side of his mouth. And she said that to Detective Curl, not Detective Hoffman, shortly after this happened. Given the standard of review that we have to have, and the statute says that we would have to say that no rational fact finder would have found guilt. If you simply look at what Detective Curl testified to that she said, how do we get there?
I think there's an easy path to getting there, Your Honor. First of all, when she gave a description to Detective Crowley immediately after the crime, she described the assailant as a heavy build and out of shape, which did not match Mr. Phillips' description. She also said that the assailant was wearing a white shirt, white shorts, had green letters or numbers on it. That's not what Mr. Phillips was wearing. I also submit that the theory of the crime, the facts that would have to be true in order to make the Commonwealth's theory correct, are totally illogical. What would have had to have happened is Mr. Phillips, who was with his friend Michael Norfleet on that day in the park, would have had to have broken free from his friend, gone off by himself, committed this rape, then taken steps quickly to change clothes because he was not found wearing anything that she described except for the hat. So he would have had to change clothes, get back into the park with Mr. Norfleet within an hour, which is when the police stop them, but leave the particularly identifying hat on. That's absurd. If you're going to take steps to cover your tracks and change your clothes, you're obviously going to take off the most identifying piece of clothing, article of clothing that you have. So I submit that, and also when the victim was asked to look at pictures and make an identification, the only thing she could say was that she recognized the hat, not the face of Mr. Phillips. So I submit there are many reasons to question her identifications, aside from the fact that she's now recanted and explained why she ever definitively.
Well, but you say she's recanted. She says I could have identified the wrong person. She doesn't absolutely say it identified the wrong person. And so that's my, I guess, first question back to you. And then second, just a couple of questions about the declaration. I don't see that it's notarized, but I'm assuming that it's accepted. And you know, Ms. Maycock Sandiford did sign it. So my understanding from this is that Deirdre Enright went to where she's living now and talk to her about this situation.
That's correct.
Who actually wrote the declaration?
who drafted the words of the declaration. I think that we drafted it based on the notes from, I don't remember whether I drafted it or Ms. Enright drafted it, but based on the notes of the conversation from with Ms. Sandiford.
Because, you know, you also, and we haven't really gotten into this yet, but you talk about the DNA extensively, particularly from SERI.
Yes.
And the declaration talks about the fact that his DNA was not found on her shorts, and that apparently really affected Ms. Sandiford considerably when she thought there was no DNA. But it makes no statement about SERI finding, and this is their words, not mine, that his DNA was included on the inside of her underpants. So, can you help me understand why it says nothing about that, but implies that his DNA was not found on any of her clothing anywhere?
So, let me see if I can take this step, and, okay. And you can direct me if I'm not answering your question. When Ms. Enright spoke to Ms. Sandiford, we reported to her the DNA results. The DNA results are that male DNA collected from the outside of the victim's shorts and underwear include the genetic profiles of several men, none of which are Darnell Phillips. There is a epithelial skin cells that were left on the interior crotch of the victim's underwear. There was an incomplete and weak profile that was obtained from that spot. They could only identify, there were only information about 3 of the 16 loci. So with that limited information, all they could say is that they could not exclude Darnell Phillips. They also couldn't exclude 1 in 23 men in the general population and 1 in 23 black men in the general population. So that information is not particularly significant or dispositive. But Ms. Sandiford was given all of the information. I believe she was given the report, the Siri report. So she was given all of the information. And I want to say her statement does not rely solely, if at all, on the DNA results. What it says is that it doesn't say, yes, you're right, it doesn't say explicitly, I picked the wrong man. But what it says is, the only reason I picked Mr. Phillips is because the police lied to me. The police told her that he had done this to other children in the past. They told her that her blood was on his underwear. They told her that his alibi was bogus, and they told her that he had confessed. Those were all lies that the police told her in order to secure her identification at the time of trial, because prior to trial, she had been unable to definitively identify Mr. Phillips.
Counsel, you may continue. I know you're answering Judge Beals' question, but you're well into your rebuttal time.
I would like to save the rest for a moment.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel?
Thank you,
Please court. Yeah, thank you. Please court, Your Honor. Matthew Dolan, Senior Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Commonwealth this morning. Mr. Phillips, through counsel, claims that the Commonwealth at trial lied in order to convict him, whereas it's his petition that seems to stretch the truth in directions. As Judge Beals already noted, the victim, we contended, did not recant. We referred to it in our all pleadings as purported or proffered recantation. The significant point of a recantation is that the victim claims that some of her testimony at trial was wrong or mistaken or false. As pointed out, she was told that DNA exonerated Phillips. That's at least premature, if not actually untrue. That decision hadn't been made by any competent body yet. It's certainly his position in the pleading, and I wouldn't be surprised if counsel communicated their earnest position when they spoke to the victim about this and got her statement. But her statement
Mr. Dulligan,
is an explanation of how she could have been mistaken, not that she was. Yes,
Judge. I hate to interrupt, as I did with your opposing counsel,
please,
but time goes by so fast here. How do you explain her declaration where she says, I was never sure about anyone in those pictures. To be honest, I could hardly tell one man from the next. I was really confused. When they came to my house one night and woke me up, I knew they weren't going to stop until I identified someone.
I don't know how to explain what her recollection now is. I think in the context of petitions, the important thing to pay attention to is how that compares to her testimony at the trial in 1991. In a trial, she not only was able definitively to identify Mr. Phillips, she said that the sketch that she had worked with to develop was the assailant.
But counsel, how are we to look at the recantation in terms of in light of the testimony? Meaning, does a recantation cast doubt upon what it was that she testified to by indicating that she was unsure or not clear and felt either coerced or pushed into a position? That's essentially what she's alleging in the recantation. That's the first question I have for you. And the second question is, what's your position in terms of this being a recantation if, in fact, it is in whole or in part drafted by counsel as opposed to the words of the victim?
What I think you need to take when weighing them two and seeing if it is a recantation or trial testimony is, first, apparently she was not given an opportunity to compare her trial testimony or recall her trial testimony. We've already identified one variance in the statement and her trial testimony. There was only one composite referred to a trial. In her statement, she's recalling that there might have been as many as three. At trial, she expressly denied being coached in her testimony. She's now recalling that people told her what to say. In her statement, she's saying that she couldn't tell the difference among the different, she said, black men and African-American men whose photos were shown to her. At a trial, she described having rejected Mr. Perez and Mr. McNair as not being the appropriate ones, and while she couldn't pick one, she picked pictures that were more similar to the assailant. She can make distinguishing judgments in the appearance. She also describes in her statement that she saw lots of photos. She says she saw yearbooks. She doesn't remember being shown photos at the hospital. Clearly, she was shown photos at the hospital based on Detective Curley's statements and the exhibits shown at trial. She was shown the two arrays shown as exhibits at trial. There was no testimony at trial about yearbooks. That not only shows that, unsurprisingly, her memory 26 years later is not as good as her memory at trial, but it also suggests fairly strongly that she had no opportunity to review her testimony and decide if that was still an accurate testimony. All the statement is, we'd submit, is the best recollection she had 26 years later without review of any of the prior facts. And in answer to your second question, all the statement is really is what Phillips' counsel has chosen to include of their interview with her coming forward. I don't suggest anything in the statement is outright false. She did apparently review under penalty of perjury and sign it. But we do not know if it's a complete narrative of what she said. And we do not know, in answer to the questions put to counsel, exactly what she was told about the DNA evidence. They believe they showed her the report. I'm not sure I would understand those reports without some help and review and study on what they mean. There's no suggestion that they explained the report to her or that they explained it differently than they believe it's explained here. The DNA evidence, they argue, is important because it's excluded from the exterior of the clothing, but as has been noted, and they ultimately acknowledge in their reply brief, he is not excluded from the interior sample. It is a weak and incomplete sample. I certainly acknowledge that, and if this were his trial and I were deciding whether to prosecute, I might have concerns about whether, if that were my only evidence.
How are we to take the biological evidence, though, in relation to the Supreme Court case in Brown? I mean, how are we to view it? Because the Supreme Court has essentially two different views or holdings in Brown as it relates to the biological. One, that it's prescribed by the statute that if it's not done by the state lab, that it's not to be considered. Another, sort of giving weight to the credibility of the witness that may be developed. How would you indicate that we should take the DNA evidence that we have here in relation to our petition?
I think I understand the Brown question. I'm not sure I understand the second part of the question.
Just how are we to look at it in terms of the way that our statute for actual innocence is crafted?
Yes. I think counsel's view of Brown is narrower than what the Brown decision actually says. It relies specifically in part of its analysis on the language of the statute that governs writs in the Supreme Court based on testing of biological evidence. But it's broader than that. It looks also to not only the testing statute, but to the role DFS has in its own organic statutes, in its conclusion that the legislature's intent is that DFS be a gatekeeper. And it's logical in the structure of the statute to have DFS set up as a gatekeeper. As we pointed out in brief, otherwise we have a factual hill to climb in every case. This is a good example. SERI uses something they call an MVAC tool to gather samples where neither DFS nor the earlier private lab, FAS, was able to develop any genetic evidence. There's nothing I saw in SERI's report or anything else submitted by Mr. Phillips as to why someone should think the MVAC tool is a reliable tool for gathering accurate samples. If we were to try and rely on this study, in their opinion, there would have to be some evidence either in the record here or it would have to be referred to develop that evidence to show why it would be reliable. But since it's Mr. Phillips' burden, he can't count on the court to refer matters to make his scientific evidence not from DSS reliable.
So is your position that the record, if we were to take the second path of Brown, that the evidence that we have before us is, or record that we have before us, is deficient to support the reliability of the testing?
Yes. I think the point of the DFS testing is that we then have a forensic result, and we and the court can argue about things we're used to. What's the weight of the evidence? What's the relevance in terms of the whole record? What conclusions can we draw from it? And not try and be genetic analysts.
Can I ask you about the it was when it was sent to FAS after Department of Forensic Science did their testing?
Yes, ma'am.
There was a circuit court order doing so.
There was.
Is FAS a DFS approved lab?
They're not approved within the terms of the testing statute in 327.1. Right. I don't know if they have a contract with DFS in other contexts.
I understand SERI is not. Was there a circuit court order? I was looking for that in the record. Transferring it?
I'm not sure it's in the record, but it's my understanding there was a circuit court order in both cases.
Thank you.
At least the one referencing testing by SERI is described as having found good cause for the testing rather than having found the specific conditions for testing that are listed in 327.1. So were those orders appealable? There might have been a question whether the order complied with 327.1, but there was a circuit court order.
Is it the Commonwealth's contention that neither the testing done by FAS or SERI under Brown can be considered by this court, or just SERI?
It's our contention that on the record, neither one can be considered. I can't answer the court's question specifically if FAS has some contractual relationship with DFS, but there's none reflected in the record. The statute, this court has, of course, slightly different language than the actual innocence statute based specifically on biological evidence. And it does have, in the final clause, a reference to allowing the court to consider other scientific evidence. But I think the Supreme Court has spoken to how DNA evidence is to be handled in Brown, and I think that applies here. As to non-DNA scientific evidence, I think the petitioner would still have a burden not only to come forward with the evidence, but to come forward with the foundational evidence that would make it reliable and relevant and give cause for the court to give it anyway.
But your position that the DNA evidence doesn't really come into consideration unless we made a determination with regard to the purported recantation or that they operate in tandem.
This is exactly the petition that Mr. Phillips filed in the Supreme Court as a biological-based evidence. 95% of it is verbatim the same. In the Supreme Court, their understanding of their statute is that you cannot reach non-biological evidence until there's some biological evidence that comes within the end, but that was their decision in Watford, that while the biological evidence by itself did not carry the day, there was at least some that would give them jurisdiction to consider the other evidence, and in absence of that, they could not. I think this court statute is written differently and focuses first on non-biological evidence, and you can consider the affidavit by itself, even if you agree with our position that either the Seri test is inadmissible or inconclusive and proves nothing about his innocence. But I think, peculiar to this recantation, you can't give it much weight if you don't believe that the Seri test is, in fact, proof of exoneration, because that based on the statement, her understanding is wholly based on the premise that he was exonerated by DNA evidence. And in fact, she seems to understand that not only is he exonerated, but that there's a complete profile. Her final paragraph expresses the wish that this evidence will help the authorities find the real assailant.
Counsel, just circling back to what Judge O'Brien asked, just for clarification, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong with what you said, are you indicating that if we don't find that the recantation meets the materiality part of the statute, then the DNA evidence is not to be considered? Is that essentially what you're saying? It is not something the court should consider at that point.
I apologize. I hadn't taken that aspect of her question.
I thought, and I may be
incorrect.
I didn't phrase
it in the most articulate manner, so.
I think that's what she was asking, so I'm just trying to double back because I'm not sure that I understood that addressed quite that question, but perhaps I'm asking a new question. If that's a new question, do you mind answering it?
Well, and I think in the circumstances of this case, we may sidestep the question of whether it's a jurisdictional necessity to reach it. If you were to find that the recantation were not material, were not evidence itself of actual innocence, then the best that the DNA evidence rises to, as he concedes in his reply brief, is it's inconclusive as to whether he's proven to be innocent or not. That's the best you can say about it. I think it actually fails as evidence of actual innocence, since he is included in at least one of the samples his third lab developed. So in the circumstance of this case, I'm not sure we need to reach that question. If you find the recantation itself is not material, the balance of the DNA evidence is, say, at best inconclusive, and in our view, fails any test for showing that he is actually innocent. The balance of the evidence they've discussed largely is either a rehash of challenges to the confession that were decided at trial, and while they think it's absurd to believe it, the jury did believe it despite the challenges.
Can I ask you about
circumstances of
the petition in the Supreme Court that you referred to?
Yes.
What is the status of that right now?
It's pending on a pair of motions brought by each counsel. I see time expired. I believe so.
Please go and answer Judge Appeals' question.
When the
there
Brown
was a motion to null pros. That's part of my question.
When the Brown decision came out, counsel for Mr. Phillips had moved to non-suit the petition in that court on the theory that we had a pending motion for leave to file a reply.
Yes, I meant to non-suit, closed. Not null pros. Excuse me. Yeah, thank you.
In our reply, we noted that the only issue to which we'd the principal issue, the dispositive issue to which we sought leave to file a reply was the admissibility of private lab tests, which the court had now resolved, at least certainly for its own petitions, and that therefore the issues were closed, even though our reply was technically yet to be filed with the decision in Brown, and therefore pray that the court grant our motion to dismiss. Both our motion to dismiss and the motion to non-suit are still pending in that court.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Given? You have a little over two and a half, or a little over two
Thank
minutes.
Thank you. I want to note first that while the AG keeps harping on the fact that Mr. Phillips' DNA cannot be excluded from the interior sample of the underwear, the other person who cannot be excluded is somebody else, one of the male, the men who contributed DNA to the outside of the shorts. So those profiles are consistent, and that is far more likely to be her attacker than Mr. Phillips, according to this DNA evidence. And I think what's important to remember here is that this was a violent attack. She said that the assailant pulled her underwear and shorts off, that he was not wearing gloves, and so it is highly likely that the assailant left his touch DNA on those items, and it is one of those men whose DNA is on the outside of the shorts and the underwear, and whose DNA is consistent with the inside.
Can I ask you, given the Supreme Court's decision in Brown about how biological evidence that's not done by DFS or DFS-approved lab can be considered, and generally, if a petition for writ of actual innocence is based only on biological evidence, it must go to the Supreme Court. It can come to this court if you have other things that are non-biological evidence. Given that fact, and the fact that what the Supreme Court is referring to in the code would appear to apply to both courts under the two different statutes, how can we look at the SERI results given the Supreme Court's recent opinion in Brown?
So I think, and we've laid this out in our briefs, but what is clear is that in Brown, the Supreme Court was relying exclusively on the interplay of the DNA testing statute and the biological writ statute. It explicitly refers to language in both those statutes and the fact that the biological statute refers to the DNA testing statute, which requires DFS to do the testing. So there is absolutely no such language or interplay when it comes to the non-biological writ. The Attorney General is just wrong when he implies that it applies more generally. That language is explicit, and the interplay is explicit. So the basis of the Brown opinion simply doesn't apply here. And I want to say also, even if this court determines that the DNA is inconclusive or that it cannot consider the DNA, we submit that we are nonetheless entitled to the writ, because if you look what is left and what a jury here would consider, you now have no physical evidence connecting him to the crime. The hair that was used against him at trial did not belong to him. You have only the testimony of a disgraced detective, and you have perhaps inconclusive DNA evidence that the jury could consider if this court is permitted to consider it, which we submit it is. And so there's literally nothing left to connect our client to this case except the word of a now disgraced detective.
Thank you, Counsel.